Why is self-awareness the secret ingredient to good leadership? How do you let go of a critical early team member like a co-founder? And what does it take to found a company during your PhD? Welcome to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, where we explore the leadership journeys of life science entrepreneurs. I'm David Kirk, and in each episode, I sit down with a life science leader to uncover the moments that define their leadership. Today, I'm joined by Mark Gitzinger, CEO of BioVersys, a biotech based in Basel, Switzerland. BioVersys is a leader in the anti-infective space, developing new antibiotics for very highly drug-resistant infections. We'll get more into the science at the end of the episode. Mark, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Dave. Great pleasure.
So just looking at your background, you have a master's in biotechnology, like myself, PhD in the synthetic biology space. You got yours from ETH Zurich, and you founded BioVersys as a PhD student. So in keeping with the spirit of A Call to Lead, what called you to lead so early in your career?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, I was really interested in doing something during my PhD that could be applied. And that was the first reason why I chose the kind of PhD, the research group and so forth that I joined. And then I got so bored during the PhD that I thought it's good to start the company. No, I mean, jokes aside, I think what really happened is that in Switzerland, you have a great institution called Venture Lab that goes specifically to different high-tech universities, as they call it, and they do a course on how to start companies. And that literally inspired me because I saw other people that were highly motivated in that space and, you know, also in non-biotech, other high-tech environments. And this course inspired me to get started and in the end also pushed towards really founding the company and getting first patents inside, because it was one of the requirements for the final stage of the business plan competition to have the company really incorporated. And luckily, we also won later on this final stage. So that was seeding money, if you want to. And so one thing led to the other. It wasn't a conscious decision to just say, oh, I need a little bit more stress alongside the PhD.
Tell me, what was it on that course that really inspired you? Was there a particular moment during it or something that you thought, oh, I've been bitten by the business bug now?
Well, I think every founder that is young will tell you in the end that a lot of naivety is needed and is also part of the founding process, because you don't know all the things that are ahead of you. And this course helped to get the naivety transferred and a little bit more clarity, and also into a stepwise process what is needed and that it is possible. Because the beauty of the course is that it's not some business professors or something that give it to you. It's actually entrepreneurs mostly that share their experience in the different segments, like, you know, IP, legal, term sheets, investors, and whatever. And that makes it more amenable and really inspired the journey. And then we had the technology inside the lab that, you know, you could foresee the application in the medical field. And yeah, one thing led to the other. And then we said, let's get going.
And in general, in life science, you have chosen this from a young age, you know, so you've studied biology, you've done the master's in biotech. Was there something that inspired you from your personal life to get into life science in the first place?
Yeah, I think, look, my dad was a biologist as well, didn't start a company or anything, more classical career. And then there is the question, do you study the same thing that your dad? And often the reaction is probably no, not necessarily. In the end, I guess I got a little bit of passion for the field as well throughout my life. And what interested me already in school times is that in biology, you learn so much how life works. And it is quite fascinating, in my view at least, to understand, you know, the molecular biology of a cell, to see how this all, how, you know, the brain just is a brain and works, and you're like, wow, how does it function? And I think that inspired me to study the subject. And during those studies, I obviously felt more and more passion to see if whatever we study is not only basic research, but can actually lead to an application to make a difference for patients. It was a process over time.
How did your dad feel when you started the company during the PhD?
Basically strong opposition. Don't you want to do just a career with like a normal career and take a proper job? That was the first thing that my parents actually said, take a proper job. I was like, okay, I think this is proper, but yeah, there was some opposition there.
Oh, I hope that has turned. So, imagine it's turned since then.
It has, yes. It's now in the meantime, everyone is kind of happy again.
Good, good. And thinking back to those like early days of the company or early years of the company, given you started alongside a very busy PhD, what was a personal challenge or obstacle that you had to overcome?
Yeah, look, throughout the company life, there's different phases, different challenges that we all face. I think one that was memorable for me and somewhat also unpleasant was not at the early days of the company, quite a few years later. You know, obviously I didn't found the company alone. I had a co-founder also from the lab and good friends. We really thought that this is, you know, it's a great opportunity. We do this together. We had the classical discussion, you know, who's taking the role of the CEO, who's taking the role of the scientific leader. So my co-founder was the scientific leader. But after a couple of years into it and also a few problems in some of the projects, there was a decisive point where basically there was discussion around the board as well. And I was asked to let the co-founder go. And that was probably to this date, one of the biggest challenges on a personal level, because you can imagine that this is a strong relationship. You have a good friendship. You start everything together. And yeah, I was really asked and had to do this process of, changing this role. And this led also to an outcome that might understand where, you know, the friendship really broke and it was a very difficult moment. But in hindsight, it also taught me a lot because in the end, if you start a company and if you run a company, what has to be priority number one is always the interest of the company and the shareholders and stakeholders. So if that is what you have to do, you have to do it. And if that is what happens to yourself, can also happen, right? Yeah. Then that's what has to be done because it's in the interest of the company. And I think this was a heavy learning process for me, which also then led to me understanding even better the HR component and building team component for the next phases of the company.
Was it a case of the board coming to you with this and having that tough conversation with them?
I guess the board and I felt this, that it's probably a necessary step. Yeah. Without the clear recommendation of the board, I'm not sure if I would have had the courage to go through. But then the board discussed that with me, but also told me that it's my job to do. So there was no, let's say, real support. So I had to go through this myself. So, and I think again, at the time, it felt like it would be so much easier if someone else would help or do it. But I think in hindsight, it was the correct decision that I had to go through this because that's the way you learn in the end. And it was also the fair thing to do because we founded the company together in the end.
Yeah. When we look at the shared challenges among life science leaders, that board and team management certainly come up a lot. But what challenges do you see among your peers and how do you see them handling it?
Again, these challenges change a little bit with the life of a company and also the stage that you're in. What I often tell early stage or like really early founders is how to deal with the board is not necessarily an advisory board or so where you can, you know, drop off all your ideas, have then a proper discussion and see what sticks and how we go. That's really what an advisory board is for. A board is somewhat different. It has the ultimate responsibility, particularly in Switzerland, on strategy and everything. But I think here you need to also, as management team and CEO, manage the board. That means you come extremely well prepared. You come with a strong opinion on, you know, where the management wants to take, where you want to take the company. You show the board that you looked at different options, give a clear recommendation on what is your favorite option. and have this kind of discussion, not coming up with the strategy during the board meeting itself as such. And I think this distinction between advisory board and board is very important. And I saw that with a lot of early stage peers where this distinction is not as clear or as strong. So that's one of the recommendations. And then obviously throughout the company stages, other challenges arise, larger financing rounds come. The question is how many board representatives of investors do you have on the board? How many independents do you have? So the recommendation is always to have a couple of independents. Because, yeah, I think one of the most common challenges that we all have is while also board members should always have the interest of the company first, they have, if they represent investment funds, for instance, some conflicts because the fund might have a different life cycle or at the end of the fund. So maybe an exit is more opportune than continuing to build value in the company, et cetera. These are just simple examples. But you have always these challenges to deal with at the board. And I think that's one of the leadership topics that we all face in biotech, particularly in biotech, because of the very long development life cycle.
Definitely. In fact, we've just been talking about it, I think, last month in Life Science Org, an awful lot of how to pick the right independent chair, how to pick good independent directors for your board. I'm curious, how do you find a good independent director? Who makes the best independent director, in your opinion?
It's not easy. Here's my recommendation to really, if possible, get to know the person for real, not just a recruitment process, meet two times or so. But if you have the chance, even maybe have the person first as a board observer for a little while or be part of it a little bit, see how the person works before and also interacts with other board members before you then fully get the person voted in and on the board. If you have that luxury, that's a recommendation because you feel really how you work together. Certainly experience is important in that role, I think, because especially for younger teams, younger founders, it's the first rodeo. So experience helps. And then maybe in the term of experience, it's experience in the field, but it's also experience in boards because first-time board members that come straight out of management, you know, it's also a learning process. How do you make the distinction between operational management and being on the board and having a certain distance, letting also management do their job and work? So I think experience is a key point, not only in the industry, but also ideally already having been on boards.
Yes, and try before you buy. Because once they're
possible,
on that board,
not always possible, yeah. Right?
Yeah. At least getting to know them, knowing that they fit with the team. I think that's a very great point to bring up. Talking about peer-to-peer learning, which obviously we're very big on in Life Science Org. And you've been through this accelerator process as well. I'm wondering if you've had maybe mentors through that, but I'd love to know what valuable lesson have you learned from a colleague or a peer over the years that you could not have learned through formal education?
It's not such an easy question. Bottom line is, yes, there is mentors and there's people that inspire you on the journey. For me, our board chair clearly is, I was there very lucky. We have a long-term relationship. I feel that I get a lot of mentorship from there with the right governance as well. So I need to do a lot of lessons kind of myself, but I'm guided to not do the biggest mistakes kind of thing. I feel that this is very strong mentorship because you truly learn, but at the same time, you're sometimes a little bit protected in front of your own potential mistakes. But there's other people along the way, you know, partially coming from partners. We were in the lucky situation that since a long time, we have a large pharmaceutical partner company. You see people in that inspire you. You see, I also worked for a while, thanks to a business plan competition with an external coach that even came from a different industry, but still was very experienced in leading. And he was mostly a turnaround manager. So I could use this person as well as coach. I think here my recommendation is if you have the luxury to work with experienced people, and I think that's one of the coolest things of starting an own company, not only in our line of business, is that you have an exposure to really a lot of very experienced people, probably more than you would have in a standard career. simply because of the role you take. And this is inspiring, and you should always be quite attentive and open eyes what you can learn from different people.
And dealing with all of these experts, what have you learned from that as a young founder, especially going forward? What was your biggest takeaway?
Yeah, I think one of the topics that you have as a young founder is you have very long working hours because you have to, on the job, learn a lot. And how do you learn? You obviously read, you look at experiences from others, etc. But you also, and this is a key advice I have, you have to ask. So meaning when there is new challenges coming up, topics that you see for the first time, may it be regulatory, may it be something else, is not your core expertise yet. My suggestion is always kind of ask three experts in the field and discuss the topic with them. Generally speaking, my experience is also here, you will get three different answers on how your problem can be best solved. And that's now a key recommendation, I think, in leadership is, in the end, you listen to those three suggestions or answers of those three experts, and you have to own your own decision afterwards. Yeah, don't fall into the trap that you say, oh, this advisor told me to do such and such. That's not good, because the advisor is, number one, never responsible for it. You have to own, you are responsible for the company and for your team. That means out of this advice, make an informed decision and stand and own your own decision afterwards. I think that's a really important lesson for me in leadership to go forward.
I think that's a perfect lesson. Certainly taking that ownership, that accountability is the mark of a good leader.
Yeah, and it's also something that is very important in startups anyway, and in small companies. You have different personalities, and also when you hire people, I think one of the personality traits in smaller companies is that you need a lot of people that are able to take own decisions, own them, and move forward. Because we have not large enough teams and often not enough time to, you know, have too many people that need very detailed instructions on the day-to-day job or have difficulty to take decisions with insecurities, because there is a lot of insecurities. That is risk. That means you can also do wrong. Yeah. And I think in small companies, you really need people that are able to handle this risk, take decisions. And it's also a piece of the management of the team in the company, because you basically have to allow for mistakes. And that's a cultural question. Because if you're super angry or disappointed if a small mistake happens because someone took a wrong decision, but they took a decision, then that often leads to the fact, okay, in the future, I won't decide anymore. And I think that's the contrary of what you want in biotechs. I think so my credo here is everyone is allowed to do a mistake, ideally not do the same twice. That's when it leads to unhappiness. But I rather have people that actually move forward. And then sometimes, you know, a mistake happens, then you need an open culture, quickly communicate and see that you can correct as fast as possible, but not be angry at it.
I think that's a great credo to live by. Before we talk about BioVersys in a little more detail, tell me about the Basel biotech ecosystem, because it is one of the biotech capitals of Europe. Tell me what is exciting and inspiring about being in Basel right now.
I would say nearly everything. Basel is a great biotech hub, and it's a unique situation, maybe somewhat comparable to Boston. I mean, you have two of the largest pharmaceutical companies in town, and you can actually see them from one building to the other, basically. So it's really close by. Everything is very condensed. Besides that, you have quite a lot of other pharma companies, obviously here, European headquarters or commercial entities. You have the CDMOs like Lonza here. And then you have a very vibrant biotech space. So, you know, just walking the streets or using the drum, you have to sometimes be careful what you talk about, because there's certainly someone that actually understands you in the background from the same industry. And I think that's the exciting part. We have great talent here. We have a great exchange between the people and knowledge transfer. You have the possibility to get talent from the early stages research, because we also have great universities, all the way to late stage clinical development, including commercial. All the expertise is in amongst, you know, that very small parameter that is Basel.
It's wonderful. And now BioVersys is in amongst them. As a leader, you have chosen to address antimicrobial resistance. Tell me about this challenge. Tell me, what does it mean for patients, and why have you chosen to pursue it?
Yeah, it's a big challenge, really, on multiple fronts, by the way. Antibiotics and antimicrobial resistance. So antibiotics is pretty much the oldest drug class that we have. And, you know, there's a lot of generics out there, and these generics work very well as long as you don't have resistant bacteria. And at the same time, antibiotics are absolutely critical to medicine, to everything we do in medicine, by the way. To my knowledge, there hasn't been a single drug that had such a huge impact on life expectancy globally than antibiotics. And the reason is that even in modern medicine, antibiotics forms the infrastructure. You know, you cannot do simple surgeries, but you can also not do advanced immuno-oncology without having access to working antibiotics. The problem now is that nature goes its way, and we have really heavily increasing numbers of drug-resistant infections. That's a scientific challenge. I think here we are quite well on top of it. But then there is in this field also commercial challenges. We had missed successes. We had missed successes that were also, I think, maybe a little bit coming from the field itself and the companies themselves continuing to develop antibiotics the way we always used to do in the 80s, 90s, even early 2000s, going to let's say rather low-hanging fruit, simple infections, where the generics are so cost-effective, et cetera, that new drugs are difficult to position in the market. On the other hand, we need this innovation also to go to the right clinical trials of very difficult-to-treat intensive care unit patients, et cetera. And that's all part of the whole story, including then the additional challenge that has come by regulators, where basically new antibiotics, you are very limited in the allowance, how much marketing you're allowed to do. It should be appropriate stewardship, so use them as rarely as possible. And that obviously limits then a little bit the commercial perspective, while you have to remain in, you know, cost comparison that is not necessarily equal to orphan drugs. And I think the challenge is massive, but we need it. So bottom line, what decided on our side to continue and focus on the space is, number one, we had technology and projects that really worked, and we saw the difference in early days in animal models. And now in latest days, I can be super happy to also report that we saw the effect in clinical trials. So I can really say we saved already a couple of lives during our clinical trials, which would have not survived if it wouldn't be for our drugs. So that's very rewarding. But at the same time, as a leader in the space, we had to decide we need to do more. So we went into policy. We created with other companies together a policy organization that I still happen to lead as president. And we also spoke to politicians around the world, particular focus on in Europe, but also in the US, to see, hey, how can we solve the commercial conundrum? And the really cool thing is we started this 10 years ago and we see progress. So Europe has decided on a new reimbursement model for antibiotics, which is so-called transferable exclusivity voucher. The UK has a new system that is implemented now with subscription models. So bottom line is I'm happy to say that, yeah, persistence in this case helped not only on the scientific development, but also to see if we can change hopefully the world to a slightly better place in addressing a long-term issue, which is drug-resistant infections. Because one thing is for sure, that won't go away miraculously. You need innovation in this space. And yeah, I think we're on a good track. So that's satisfying in that sense.
It preempted a bit of my next question, and it's great to hear all of these organizations coming together, especially around policy, because that's where the decisions get made on the national level. But the follow-up question I want to ask you is, what can we in the whole ecosystem, and I say we, meaning not just your own team, scientists, but investors, pharma companies, regulators, and I think in the case of antimicrobial resistance, healthcare systems themselves, what can we do to address this challenge of antimicrobial resistance?
I think one key point is knowledge and speaking about it. Because what we do have, and that's a conundrum, we have today somewhat a stigmatization. A lot of the infections that are really highly drug resistant and are problematic, meaning leading to casualties, to death, are hospital acquired infections. And just think about the name of what I just said. It's an hospital acquired infection. That means the stigma lies on the hospital that they did a mistake. And I hate this, because if you have ever visited an intensive care unit and you know the amount of stress and what happens in there, to blame the hospital that an infection happens is, excuse my language, but that's bullshit. I think every hospital is taking care a lot of the hygiene measures of all the things that you have to do in good care. But things do happen and they are unavoidable. And why is this important in the whole field? Because this stigmatization leads to severe underreporting of the reality. It leads to the fact that not enough exchange and information exchange is done between surgeons, oncology specialists, and infectious disease specialists, even in hospitals. And that with the combination of this underreporting and not enough discussion, we often lead to cases of wrong treatment and not fast enough decision making. You have to remember that a bacterial infection, you do not have time. 12 to 24 hours too long on the wrong antibiotic leads to the fact that the infection is well advanced and the patient might not be savable anymore. It's not like oncology, where a week might not make a difference at all in the treatment outcome. But here you speak about hours. So, and that's why it's important, and we can all contribute to this, particularly in the field, that also if you are in the field of oncology or immunology, you have to understand that a certain proportion of your patients, which is actually quite high, will, during their treatment, face the issue of potentially an infection. And that's not when you have to close your eyes. It's when you have to speak up and say, look, how do we diagnose fast? How do we get the right drug into these patients as well? I think that's, for me, really quite important and could make quite a bit of difference in the field.
I think you're very right. I know Clostridium difficile, my background working in Clostridium. And funnily enough, I had to go in for surgery. My appendix burst when I was 30 years old, a ripe old age to have appendicitis. But I was working in a Clostridium difficile lab at the time. Yeah, I can see your eyes widening. It is ridiculous. But of course, the hospital was across the road from the university. It was a university hospital. And when I told the doctor this, they had that similar look on their face, this huge eyes of, oh no. Fortunately, I was okay. And I haven't heard any reports of difficile outbreaks at that hospital. But again, as you say, there could be underreporting, there could be this fear, and it's not their fault. But for that bug in particular, they form highly resistant spores that are generally undetectable. What do you do in that situation?
I mean, you know, your story is striking and it's clear how important it is. And you would have not survived that episode without working antibiotics. That's clear. We had recently a similar example, very tragic, in Switzerland. Most people have heard about this incredible fire on New Year's Eve in Crans-Montana. And a lot of those patients that survived were obviously heavily burned patients. And unfortunately, one of the patients that was very heavily burned, I think something like, I heard 80 to 90% of the skin was burned, but was on a very good track to recover. But on, I think, months two or three, got Acinetobacter baumannii, which is exactly the pathogen that we treat in our lead acid. And for us, it was clear that this will happen in different patients that are so heavily burned, because the pathogen loves this and it's so hard to protect of it if you have such huge wounds, right? And here the only point is, and we have the possibility to to develop drugs that serve those patients and effectively treat very quickly these infections. We have the means. The field has suffered a lot because of mainly economic reasons. It is not as lucrative as having a chronic patient that for the rest of their life is under drug. It is not as lucrative as a lot of the oncology drugs at the moment, which is somewhat a joke because you do have cases of, for instance, leukemia patients or so that go through all the surgeries, bone marrow replacement, potentially the long treatments costing several hundred thousand, and then they die because you decided to give a $50 antibiotic rather than a $10,000 antibiotic. And you have to wonder what on earth drives this. So there is structural things that need to change and improve. But I think we're on a good way. That's the positive thing because the reimbursement changes. That means also the financial burden that is today often on the hospital. Don't underestimate that. The cost of a new antibiotic sits mostly in the DRG code, so on the hospital, rather than actually a proper reimbursement code. So there's lots of things that need to change and that are changing. So that's positive. And the good news is as well, thanks to companies like ours, but also other colleagues, the innovation has not totally stopped. We have new answers and weapons in development, very scarce, and we need more. That's also clear. But I want to leave really with a positive note on this because, yeah, the innovation is here and we're getting to the patients.
That's funny. When I did my undergraduate, vancomycin was this big, big thing. And they were already starting to see resistance to it. And now, obviously, we're quite a few years on from those days.
Well, you know, Dave, there I have, this is a different anecdote. There's, you lost a little bit track of the, since you were basically in the lab, because at the time, everyone was so afraid that vancomycin could lead to massive resistance and we would have VRSA. So not only MRSA, but VRSA. This has actually never really happened. So in the lab, you can create it and people were afraid, but in the field, we see probably below 2% VRSA, which is interesting because it shows us scientists the humbleness of, unfortunately, we can't really predict the trajectory. And why this is important is from a policy point of view, we have infections where today already the resistance is through the roof and you have real issues. Yeah. So particularly in the gram-negative space today. And obviously you need to develop new drugs. And that's currently the only space where we can actually commercially successful develop new drugs. On the other hand, we in the field should prepare for the next black swan event. So what is the next resistance to one of the key antibiotics that we have, like vancomycin? Maybe it still happens eventually, right? But it hasn't prevailed so far. And how do we prepare for this with the long development times to have something ready when it happens? Because when it happens with a bang, lots of lives are lost until you have the next answer. And that's one of those key questions as well that you discuss with policymakers. And humanity is incredibly bad because we also knew before COVID that eventually something like this would happen, but no one really prepared much for it. And we were damn lucky with the mRNA vaccines. And so how do we prepare for infectious disease outbreaks? We had now Hunter virus, but that was obviously contained really quickly. Imagine this thing goes from human to human quickly. Eventually it will happen again. Every decade, you have a virus jumping from animal to human. And every probably 100 years, you have one like the COVID or so that actually spreads really fast as well and has an associated mortality. And actually, it's interesting in the life expectancy curve, you have this massive, you know, increase of nearly 25 years with the rise of antibiotics being commercially available. And you have, I think it's a 2 or 3 year dip in the life expectancy during COVID that then comes back up. So you really see that these kind of infectious disease, it's not just, you know, small fun episode. It really makes a massive difference. But the challenge is how to prepare if you don't know exactly what the disease is yet and you prepare a drug that by definition you're waiting for an outbreak. Who pays for that? And how much?
Finally, Mark, our podcast is a call to lead, and you've shared some wonderful stories and insights with me. Thank you so much for that. But there's always our secret, I say secret last question I tell everybody. Is there anything on the leadership journey that we haven't talked about that you would like to end your episode on?
That's a big one. Look, I thought about this a fair bit also when I give to other founders, you know, a little bit my experience and share. And I think in terms of leadership, with the background where we come from, it's often scientific education, etc. You're not taught much about leadership, and you're not taught a lot about how to deal with different people and personalities. And for me, one of the key points is, if you start a company like this, is the point of self-awareness. Basically understand that lots of people, your employees, at least until you have a certain size, until, you know, at least the first 50 employees or so, a lot of focus is on you and how you lead. And this self-awareness and realization is already a big, big step. Because if you don't like certain behaviors in meetings, if you don't like, you know, certain behaviors in how the research is done or so in your company, often look into the mirror helps a lot, because people actually adjust a little bit how you self behave and lead, for instance, meetings, etc. And I think this self-awareness helps. I don't want to give any recommendations on culture per se. I feel that different cultures can all lead to a good outcome. It just needs to be the right culture for the right team. And in the end, that's what the founders and what you as leader often said. And then ideally you maintain a certain culture that fits yourself. Because if you have to always put a mask on or a game on to just fulfill some kind of culture that is not you, it's also not good leadership. It doesn't work. And so I think self-awareness is a bit of the secret sauce, because that normally leads to reflection and also action.
What is that self-awareness? How do you acquire that? Is it something that you can do in a vacuum, or do you need people around you, specific people?
In my view, the first step is really kind of in the vacuum, that you self-realize, oh, I did this kind of action and it led to this kind of reaction. And there you really reflect on yourself. What are things that I'm happy with in the company culture, and how people react, and where I'm unhappy? And the points where I'm unhappy, did I trigger this, those maybe? And then when you did this self-reflection, I think it's also time to go maybe to the outside, find a mentor or find someone to discuss, okay, how could this be changed for the better? So I think the first step is really in self-awareness, as the word says, a bit in a vacuum and some reflection.
I suppose, yes, you can't seek out help unless you know you need it.
That's kind of the point, yes.
Mark, thank you so much for your time today. It was great to have you share your leadership journey with us, and I hope your challenges and your stories will resonate across our community in LifeScience.org and beyond. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dave. Very pleasant discussion.
It's no secret that Europe is a global leader in generating translational science. We're grateful at LifeScience.org to have a community of over 400 life science CEOs, leaders driving change in biotech, medtech, tech bio, and healthcare. The conversations inside our community, stories of conviction, navigating challenges, and making bold decisions, inspire us every week. To hear the stories, lessons, and experiences of our life science leaders, listen to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, available on all good podcasting platforms.